From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley, San Francisco.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haight.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside, SF.
Coming up, we'll meet someone who's totally focused on making life perfect for hockey players.
Someone lays on the ice. If you're down with a broken leg, your clothes will freeze. You'll freeze to the ice. Your clothes will freeze to the ice. And you got to be peeled off.
Then we'll hear from a queer Black artist collective on finding their voice.
Things are going to come at you. You're going to be asked to speak for everybody else. And you're most likely going to fail because you cannot do that.
And the story behind this iconic San Francisco sound.
When you can't see anything, you can tell what direction they're coming from pretty clearly.
Finding our way through the fog today on Cross Currents. Tonight, hockey fans across the Bay Area are hunkering down to watch the San Jose Sharks hit the ice and face off against the Pittsburgh Penguins for the Stanley Cup. But have you ever thought about just how the ice you see on your TV gets made? Hint, it's a lot more complicated than you think. The specialist's Casey Miner has more.
Because people who know me, they know I'm not going to be around Monday night because this is where I come. This is what I do.
Mark Thompson and I are at the Dublin Iceland Skating Rink in Dublin, California. It's Monday, which means Monday Night Hockey, which Mark's been to almost every week since 1974.
Ice rinks don't change that much, I gotta say that too. There's something about them. They're usually kind of dingy and a little smelly and old and damp. And so that part of it has never changed. There's something about an ice rink.
What does change is the ice itself. Some nights it's good, some nights it's bad. And there's a person whose job it is to know the difference. I'm Casey Miner, and this is The Specialist. So we'll go back to Dublin, Iceland. Monday night hockey lasts a few hours, so we've got time. But first, let's head about 30 miles south to San Jose, home of the Sharks, the Bay Area's only professional hockey team.
Got hired here, never skated in my life.
This is the Sharks ice guy, Richard Rocha. His actual title is Director of Operations, but we'll be going with Ice Guy. And he didn't start out caring or even knowing much about ice. He was more into golf and tennis. 10 years later, though, he is no longer a newbie. He goes to conferences about ice. He reads Rink magazine. He goes to an annual trade show.
Bunch of Rink folks, as I am now a part of.
Rink folks. So he's totally in this world. And this is a world where ice matters. Rinks have reputations. So Rocha is used to hearing about the quality of his ice.
What's going on here? You guys put too much water down, those types of things.
A good ice guy doesn't just pour some water in a cold place, then stand back and admire his handiwork. He monitors the ice all day. Because though the rink is cold, people are warm. The warmer it gets, the more players can slow down. Maybe they hit holes or soft spots in the ice, then fall down. That's called catching an edge. Warm ice also makes the puck bounce. Not good. If those kinds of things happen too much, well, it means you have kind of a shitty ice rink, which is not okay for professional hockey. Asking the players to skate on bad ice would be like asking track stars to run in the mud. So Richard Rocha is always paying attention.
The only thing we're really worried about is anything that could possibly melt the ice. If for some reason we do have injuries from time to time, but if someone lays on the ice, if you're down with a broken leg, and it has happened, your clothes will freeze. You'll freeze to the ice. Your clothes will freeze to the ice, and you got to be peeled off. So you know all that type of stuff happens.
And it starts happening immediately. From the moment Rocha builds the perfect ice, it starts to fall apart. But let's not go there yet. First, imagine starting from nothing. The platonic ideal of an ice rink is yours to create.
When we start from scratch, it's a cement slab.
A wide cement floor needs to be clean. Then you cover it with a thin layer of water.
From there, we spray white ice paint on it. You know, make sure you get a good thorough layer on there. That's a base for our look and feel and how, you know, lights reflect off of the rink and all that stuff is very important.
Ice paint is a special kind of paint. It's what makes an ice rink look like an ice rink.
And then from there, you can go ahead and start laying out your lines, your goal creases, find out your face-off dots, you know, and then everyone likes the big shark head.
They are the San Jose Sharks, after all. And side note, back in 1990, when the team was just forming, people sent in 5,000 suggestions for a name. The winner was actually Blades, but the owners thought that sounded too weapon-y. So they went with Sharks, which I guess is less violent. I don't know. Anyway, so it's all laid out, that ice rink look you see on TV all created. Now it's time for more water.
And we actually use a fire hose, get out there just like a firefighter, and we're spraying, you know, once there's a good base going. It may take, you know, 20 to 30 minutes to wet the entire rink, and then it may take an hour or two for it to freeze solid, and you go out there and repeat the process.
Add more water, freeze it. Add more water, freeze it. As may be obvious by now, it's arduous and time-consuming to build ice from scratch. Rocha says they actually only do it every 3 to 5 years. So once people start skating, their goal is to maintain. Break the ice down, build it back up again. There's a specialist for that too.
And once we get, you know, about 3/4 of an inch of ice, our guys go out there and begin with a Zamboni.
The Zamboni is the giant truck that drives around and smooths out the ice. It's technically called an ice resurfacer in the same way that a Kleenex is technically called a facial tissue.
And the important thing there is to use hot water. So the goal is to use hot water to create a nice, hard, solid sheet of ice.
And then, when it's perfect, you have to wreck it. Start skating, create ruts and fractures, which then get filled with new water, making the whole thing stronger. This is a key step. You can't skip it.
Many a times we've said, hey, we need a group of 20 guys to go out there and break in the sheet of ice.
This is true from the biggest professional ice rink to the humblest recreational one. Remember Dublin, Iceland? Breaking in the ice is something the guys at Monday Night Hockey love to do. And every week is a new test of their patience. Because though it is very tempting to hit that cool, shiny surface as soon as the Zamboni finishes, doing that basically guarantees bad ice. Mark Thompson, remember him from the beginning of this? He's the one who's been unavailable on Monday night since 1974. He told me the hockey guys pride themselves on waiting. They're willing to hold out for better ice. Mostly.
What do you think is the sound of people waiting for ice to dry?
What is that sound?
Yeah.
a lot of grumbling and, I'm going to go, I want to go, I want to skate. Very impatient, you know, when guys get out here. And it's hard holding them back. It's funny because some of the guys will just come out and just start skating around and then we got to go, wait a second, hold off. If you wait a second, you know, wait for 5 minutes, we'll have better ice the whole night.
Sometimes, though, the ice is just bad, and there's really nothing you can do to make it better. Remember, this is California. The air is warm. The night I visited, it was really warm, and the players could tell.
How's the ice?
Yeah, it's a little sticky, I think. I'm just getting warmed up on it. I find it's warm tonight, so it's a little slow on the ice. It sort of drags. I suppose when it's colder and it just glides, there's a little stickiness to it. It's like pasta that's overcooked. You know, it's like it's sticky like that a little bit, you know, supposed to that smooth baby's ass kind of deal, you know?
Good ice, like a baby's ass. Richard Rocha, of course, did not put it this way, but he's doing his part to give guys like Luke that experience on the ice, building it up and scraping it down, building it up and scraping it down. It's about 2,000 gallons of water a day. You'd only really see that water as water, though, if something went really wrong. At one point, Rocha takes me out back to see the coolant system, this big room with whirring machinery, like a computer data center.
If this were to go down, what would happen in there?
We'd have a leak. We would have a leak, yeah, absolutely. So it's not ideal.
Not ideal. As we head back in, I ask him the thing I really wonder about every specialist.
Did you ever think you would know this much about ice?
Absolutely not. No. Absolutely not.
Thanks, Ice Guy. And hey, who are you again?
Hi, I'm Richard Rocha. Welcome to Sharks Ice.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
I really appreciate that.
I'm Casey Miner for Cross Currents.
That was an excerpt from the new podcast, The Specialist, a show about work we don't think about and the people who do it. Find past episodes in the iTunes store or on our podcast page. It's kalw.org/subscribe. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Tasha Sian and Brontez Purnell are members of Blank Map, a Bay Area collective of queer Black artists, performer, musicians. They describe their collaborative work as, quote, Black abstractions influenced by punk, queer, and feminism. Sian and Purnell spoke to KALW's Jen Chien about making art that embodies Blackness without being about Blackness.
From the description, it sounds like this show is fairly experimental, experiential. It's non-traditional performance, it's safe to say. Tell me what an audience might expect to see or hear at the show if they come to the show.
It's unconventional, but you'll definitely see, I guess, conventional elements of performance in the sense that we're moving on stage. There's a set, there's sound.
Live drumming.
Light and shadow play, levels, that kind of thing. Like all the things that are...
Boobs.
Yes.
There will be boobs.
Skin.
I use a lot of coconut oil.
I think in a way it's like we're using a lot of really conventional things in unconventional ways. And I think I threw out the term during one of our conversations, Astronanya, which is about defamiliarizing the familiar.
Astronanya?
Astronanya. I think it's a Russian term, but it literally just means making the familiar strange. So we have a lot of the elements that you would see in a lot of performance, but... the way we're engaging with them and even the way we're presenting them to a certain extent is like kind of freaked in that way. So
I have to say, as someone who spent a fair amount of my time in weird experimental improvisational dance and art circles, it's a very white world, that world. And so it's very refreshing and pleasing to me personally to see a group like you, a group of solely people of color doing this kind of thing. Do you guys feel in some way like unicorns?
I have often thought about how I am probably the only Black man who contact improvs, and I've thought about it often.
And that's contact improvisation for listeners who might not know. It's a very specific form of improvisational dance.
It's pretty weird. I heard that there's some other guy somewhere in New York who's into it, and I keep hoping to meet him one day. I've sent out SOSs. text. That's another reason why I like completely said yes to this, you know what I mean? Because I just thought it was a chance to, I don't know, like make some, not necessarily like make something new, but maybe make something that hadn't really been like thought of. And there's definitely like people of like color performance and definitely like Black performance in the Bay Area, but I feel like the general aesthetic of what that looks like is so far from what we've from like kind of like our aesthetic and what we've established.
I think one of the things for me that makes it feel like it's not just spinning its wheels in the mud or like it's not just offering the same things in a way that isn't innovative is that Blackness and other identities or identity markers aren't necessarily statements we're trying to make, but they're part of the energy of it, of the work. Like there's no real overt concrete statement that I feel we're trying to make in this, even though one of the things that is part of what brought us together and I guess part of the draw in terms of how this is being put out into the public is its Blackness or Black as an element. And I think Black is a facet. It's a very significant facet, but it's not the statement. It's not surface. It's more like it's enmeshed in the whole kind of system of it. So that for me allows it to be not free, but freer, because it's still complicated and it's still fettered in a lot of ways.
I'm speaking with Tasha Sian and Brontez Purnell from Blank Map, a temporary artist collective. Does that feel like something of a relief to you as artists? There can be a pressure sometimes as an artist of color to make your work always about that, or not just as an artist of color, as a person of color who has any sort of publicly available work or persona, there's a pressure to be representative of your people or representative somehow of your identity. So does it feel good to kind of let that not be what the thing is about?
I mean, yes. Okay, yes, totally. But then it's also just like I'm a performer, you know? So, and plus like being a performer so long, like so much of my art has been about my body, you know, like my body on stage, my body on display. So it's like one of those weird things where it's just like I can't really separate like my Blackness from that necessarily. But by the same time, it's like, you're not going to see me up there with a djembe and kente cloth. Like. But I mean, if people choose to do that, that's totally fine. That's just like...
But it's not your reality, or it doesn't reflect where you are, where you're coming from as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, or I was just, I don't know, I was done with that in 2006, actually. So I just feel like I played that party out. So
I guess my analog to that is like, you know, Asian American artists making work about the railroad, Chinese Americans making work about the railroad, or Japanese Americans making work about the internment camps or something like that.
No,
it's important and relevant and great, but it's not the thing that fits for everyone. And there's a generational difference, I think, too, in how people choose what their work is about.
Also just like years of like being like in like African dance companies and working like in the theater, I just felt like there just came a point where I needed like certain like kind of like ancestral things to speak to me like in a new way, or like have it be represented like in a different way, or 2.0, or like, you know what I mean? Because it's like, I don't know, like my life is very, I mean, I do want to talk about like things that have happened, but it's like my life is so different from even like my father's, like from 30 years ago, and my grandparents. It's just like how is my racial identity like affecting me like necessarily today?
Yeah, we're Black. Yeah, we know that as part of the experience of just walking through the world in these bodies, things are going to come at you. You're going to be asked to speak for everybody else. And you're most likely going to fail because you cannot do that. Yeah, that blank map is kind of operating in these like multifaceted ways where it's like, yeah, we're aware and we're also still doing this.
That was Brontez Purnell and Tasha Sien of the artist collective Blank Map. They spoke with KALW's Jen Chien, and you can see Blank Map this weekend at Dance Mission in San Francisco, Friday through Sunday. Show starts at 8 o'clock. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
Today, we thought we'd play you a story from our archives, one that matches the gray days we've been having lately. Man, I love that sound. Think you know where I recorded it? It's pretty awesome. I'll let this guy explain.
Electric Choctaw Bridge personnel, we're going to energize our foghorns for a test. Please phone in if you're near the foghorns and you do not want me to energize them. My name is Jim McKnight. I'm the chief electrician on the Golden Gate Bridge. And one of our really cool jobs is to be able to operate the foghorns. Okay, so we're going to run a test right here. And the first one you're going to hear is the low one, I believe, because it'll come on for 2 seconds. And the next one you'll hear.
And what's the science of being able to tell when you need to turn it on?
We go out and we see if it's foggy, and if it's foggy, we come back in and turn them on.
So who's listening to those? What are those for?
Mainly for our enjoyment. No, I'm kidding. It's mainly for the ships that are passing underneath the bridge, fishing boats, any maritime activity underneath the bridge. So it lets them know where they are in the channel, and they can guide in a thick fog. They can guide if the smaller boats don't have radar. It lets them know whether they're close or far, or if they're in between, you know, if they can hear the midspan horns as loud as the one on the pier, then they know they're somewhere in the middle there. They're not going to run into the bridge. And that's what they're for, so people don't run into the bridge.
My name's David McCloy. I'm a San Francisco bar pilot. And bar pilots are We're mariners that get on ships here locally and navigate them in and out of the port, anywhere from 12 miles offshore outside the Golden Gate to all the way everywhere in the bay, including Stockton and Sacramento.
See, there it is right there. See those horns on the base of the bridge structure there?
And so where are they? What sound comes from what?
Well, there's the South Tower, which has one horn, a deep, rich, long blast. And then there's the center span, which has a whistle. It's a higher pitched sound, and it's two blasts. So they're very distinctly different, and you can pick them out instantly. There's something reassuring about being able to hear those horns where they're supposed to be. And surprisingly, you can't see anything, you can tell what direction they're coming from pretty clearly.
Thanks to Dave McCloy and Jim McKnight for letting me tag along to record those amazing horns from a boat at the base of the bridge and from inside the Golden Gate Bridge. Audiograph can be so much fun sometimes. Is there a sonic treasure hunt you want to send me on? Give me a call and tell me all about it. 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. I love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. If you love Audiograph and really try hard every week to solve them, well, you definitely need to subscribe to our podcast. Hear Audiographs, catch up on past episodes of Cross Currents. It is all there at kalw.org/subscribe. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, James Rowlands, Raja Shah, Stephen Short, and Judy Silber. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Ben Trefney. Today is Shireen Adil and Ian Lewis's last day. We will miss them dearly, and congratulations to all of our Audio Academy members who are graduating today. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by San Francisco jazz producer and musician Herbie One. He takes jazz samples and live performance and mixes them with drum sounds and club grooves. Herbie One performs at Neck of the Woods in San Francisco on Sunday night. Doors open at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.